Today, of all days, I think is a great time to remember that no matter whether you're going in to teach, or you're going up to Sproul Plaza or Justin Herman Plaza, or you're going to Fruitvale later, education is political work, right? We are involved in the shaping of our world, involved in the shaping of our society. And as such, we need to just remember that. I think that today is a great day to just remember why we all got into this work, right? It's not for the beautiful weather, because we're inside all day. It's for the struggle. We're in here for the work. We're in here for the students. We're in here for the world that we want to see. So before we go in, I just want to take a minute, and I want everybody just to think, because we never get time to think as teachers, right? It's always a grind. We never get time to stop and remember why we're here. Let's take a minute and just have everybody think about what was the struggle that drew you to this work. Why did you get into this? What's the world you want to see?
This is Brett. I have a few thoughts I want to share with you before we move along into my discussion with Stephen Hicks. A couple of days ago, somebody sent me this video from Rebel Media. It was Gavin McInnes, 20 Reasons Why School Sucks. And, you know, like most Gavin McInnes videos, it was very entertaining and enjoyable, even though I thought it overlooked a couple of really important points. But there was a thread that ran through it I thought was very interesting. And one of the reasons why the video is worth watching is Gavin actually encouraged members of his audience to go out and surreptitiously collect footage from their schools. Even though it deals with, you know, pretty much all lower levels of public schooling and higher education, lots of the examples are from college classrooms, college rallies. And the second item on his list of 20 is they say education is political work. So there's a rally at Berkeley, and the MC of the event says this quote. And I just would ask you to pause and think about that. Education is political work. Education is not leading a person out of darkness or leading a person out of ignorance or anything to do with actually delivering knowledge. It is first and foremost political work. And this theme, even though he goes on to 18 reasons after that, this theme continues through many of the other higher education examples, talking about teachers recruiting for BAM by any means necessary, which was an organization that enabled or encouraged a lot of the violence around the Milo Yiannopoulos event at Berkeley a few months ago. And it might sound alarmist, and I feel like I've sounded alarmist in the past with the suggestion that many of the activities that are going on in higher education, in social sciences, and humanities have political implications that are already arriving or still yet to come. But I hope you're still contemplating carefully what I just reported to you there. Like, really pause, bathe in it. Education is political work. The context, it was a public school teachers' rally in Berkeley. The focus, I guess, was protecting students who are undocumented from Trump coming into their schools and stealing those students and sending them back to the other side of his giant wall. The mayor was there. He said, I want to have sanctuary everything. I don't care about the economic consequences of that. I just like the warm feeling of being applauded by this crowd when I say stuff like that. I'm not just saying think about what political work means, what is delivered through education as a form of political work into the minds of young people, but also what needs to be omitted to shape a specific kind of worldview that is useful politically. And I want to pause that story. I'll come back to it, but I want to transition into something that's related, and I'll tie the two together. So one of the things that comes up a lot on Facebook, and it came up in the Empathon series, is why do I care so much? Why is there so much passion and attention on this show directed towards evaluating or criticizing this fringe group of college social justice activists? Is it just a form of entertainment? A question I've asked myself. While it is entertaining, I think there is a more grave concern here that needs to be articulated. Watching this sort of self-defeating, nihilistic, mentally unwell behavior characterized by a sense of destabilization, confusion, helplessness, bitterness of college students who are coming out of certain programs of study, I think is very instructive because it acts as a kind of barometer for the messages that are being delivered in many of these programs to students. Like, we get to see the screaming and the crying and the cafeteria boycotts and the pepper spraying and the fire setting and a collection of comedic from a distance kinds of examples of what's going on in higher education. But we don't get to see inside the classroom. So we get to see a kind of angst and frustration and sense of urgency that's, I think, quite normal at that age. But we rarely get to see what is actually animating it or activating it. And because these people who are getting these messages are young and they're lacking perspective and they're dealing with all of the challenges and pressures of being that age already, this psychological unwellness is not a direct or unavoidable consequence of postmodernism or identity politics or the higher education environment. I think a lot of it just has to do with being ill-equipped to face, you know, some of the challenges of life at that age. I certainly can speak from experience that I had highly self-destructive strategies for dealing with the challenges of life at that age. When I worked in that boarding school many, many years ago, a lot of the kids who came from the inner city, they were older, you know, 16, 17 years old, higher functioning, and they engaged in a lot of what we called covert behavior. Right? They would do things behind the scenes that we as staff certainly wouldn't have been okay with. There were lots of black markets, everything from food to pornography to meds that had been cheeked. You know, you put your meds in your cheek, you pretend you swallow them, and then you can sell them to a kid who's going to have more of a special time on that drug than you do. And because they were like on the surface, they were well-behaved and they were polite, we couldn't, you know, go rapping on their doors down the hall with a nightstick and watching every move that they make. They earned, through their overt behavior, less of a hands-on approach, more freedom, more autonomy. And I hate to admit that I was a part of this in any way, even though I certainly wasn't the decision maker. One of the tactics to sort of get to the root of what was going on, you know, covertly, would be to take a lower functioning kid, a more emotionally unstable kid, usually a younger kid, and put him into that dorm or that classroom, even though based on, you know, most of the criteria, age, functional abilities, emotional stability, that boy wouldn't really seem to fit in that environment. But the administrators and the residential coordinator, I think was the title of the person who ran the residences, they would use these young boys, and maybe it was true there was a girls' campus too, I never worked there, as a kind of alarm system, right? Because the boy would see things that the staff couldn't see in the, you know, the activities of daily living. And he wouldn't want to be a rat because there would be consequences of that if he went and told staff about the things that he saw. So he would try to bottle all this stuff up while it would produce. I can remember like three examples of this, three different boys. It would bottle all of that stuff up and it would start to create greater emotional instability, acting out. And the word that the people used who ran the school, they used the word barometer for a boy who had been placed this way to function as a kind of alarm system to alert staff to covert behavior. So he would start acting out, and that's when a sort of crackdown or an investigation would begin. It was pretty demented. And obviously, this is not a perfect parallel to higher education, but it's a story that's very useful to me in understanding, like, okay, we can't see all the things that are happening in the college classrooms. I mean, this Gavin McGinnis video is interesting because students or listeners who happen to be college attendees bring cameras into the classroom and turn them on. And you see, like, PowerPoint presentations, and it's alarming. Like, I definitely recommend watching the video. But the barometer is the behavior that takes place outside the classroom, that the messaging inside the classroom, the messaging we can't hear, encourages. And I think it provides us a fuller answer to that question that I asked over and over again in the introductory episode to this ongoing exploration of the philosophical roots of social justice. What are these, you know, quote unquote, personal liberation movements or disciplines actually producing as far as attitude and affect in young people who are really not encountering, you know, what's taught in these programs with a broader philosophical or historical or social context? And I could see many people in the audience saying, Brett, who cares? Do you really think some of these fringe programs of study are going to have a far-reaching, damaging political impact or a societal impact? Well, I do think that that's something to actually be concerned about. If all of this indoctrination continues to go on in the shadows and is systematically protected from scrutiny or debate or review. And this is not, I mean, this is far less of a problem in, like, political science. Like, those academics in the review process are really, really hard on each other. But in the humanities and other aspects of social science, it's very easy because of all the identity and the emotion that's wrapped up with that. Scrutiny has almost become synonymous with oppression. So people are getting away with a lot. And this is why it's great what Jordan Peterson was able to bring to light on that Ontario television debate, where he actually goes head to head with the professor, Nicholas Mott. And we see what is being taught in the classroom. And we see from the other Jordan Peterson videos the result, right? The free speech rally that Biffo did at the University of Toronto. We see what the consequences of that teaching are in the real world. And that's just one example somebody like Peterson was able to create through, you know, some clever self-promotion, but also through just a series of fortunate and unfortunate circumstances. One of the reasons why this is of a greater concern for me is knowing the history of education, if we want to call it that, in America in the 21st century. It was fairly fringe groups of fairly sheltered academics who were able to play a very, very significant role in shaping the schools of the 20th century from the first decade with John Dewey going forward through the progressive era, the behaviorists. None of their science, quote unquote, or their vision required any mainstream acceptance for it to become a fixture in public education and have an impact on me and probably almost everybody listening to this. All that was required, and I'm saying this happened in history, that doesn't mean that history is going to repeat itself in the exact same way. I'm just saying for me, it is a cause for concern. All that was needed for these fringe ideological movements to have a major, I would say, negative impact on American society in the 20th century was the decision of scientific managers that whatever they were doing had some kind of political use, had some kind of political application, and then, you know, several types of fanciful academic explorations or straight out pseudoscience or utopian visions of the future get onboarded into this system of government agencies and think tanks and corporate interests and private foundations, and they take off from there. In the 1900s, in the 1910s, in the 1920s, in the 1930s, in the 1960s, and apparently in the 2010s, education, especially higher education, is political work. Now, I want to keep this kind of vague because this is an off-the-record conversation that I had with a professor at an Ivy League school. And she didn't say I couldn't say anything about it, but I just want to be as respectful as possible to anonymity here. So this woman was telling me, and she is not going to be a guest on the show, I have asked, that one of the current frustrating political conflicts that she's dealing with at her school is around setting up a humanities program for undergraduate students. And right now, they're in this planning stage where they're talking about basically a framework and a focal point for this humanities. I don't think it's an entire program. It's something smaller. I missed a couple of details. But the important thing is there's going to be a focal point that the curriculum is built around. And one of the challenges that the planners are having that they've, you know, discovered in these meetings is that a lot of these undergraduate students don't have any philosophical background. They haven't read, you know, the great books of philosophy. They have had no exposure through their prior schooling to the great books of philosophy, just like many of us, including myself, have not had that. Now, the difference is, like, these are people at an Ivy League school who are probably moving forward through this humanities program to graduate work, to PhD work, and possibly ultimately, likely ultimately, to academic careers. But the foundation of their philosophical knowledge is fairly shaky because most of these great works of philosophy have been removed from the curriculum at the point where they should have encountered them to pursue that kind of work in life. So there's this question of, oh, well, what to do if they don't have this background knowledge? Because apparently that ship has sailed. There's no going back to correct that. So the professor that I know suggested that they pursue a study of Hegel, specifically the master-slave dialectic, and this would be a useful focal point to pull in various types of literature to discuss. One of her opponents in the planning meeting said, no, this is too abstruse. It's not useful to understand Hegel. What we should do is focus on poetry. And I'm not saying there aren't learning opportunities in the reading, analysis, and critique of poetry, but the focus should not be on Western philosophy and its implications. It should focus instead entirely on fascism or intersectionality. Now, the conspiracy theorist might look at this chain of events over, you know, a course of a couple decades in higher education and say, that's interesting that these great works of Western philosophy have been removed. So now students don't have that kind of background knowledge. So we can't be too hard on them and demand they develop an understanding of these complex foreign concepts. Instead, we should take advantage of their lack of background knowledge, of their shaky philosophical foundations, and we should teach them about current hot topics like fascism, because the Russian-appointed Republican president of the United States and all of his supporters are fascists, haven't you heard? So that's a timely subject. And the other was intersectionality, which has like some value philosophically, but nothing other than catastrophes await when it is applied politically. So this is the conversation that's happening right now at an Ivy League school. I'm sorry that I didn't explain it perfectly. I could try to get more information and explain it to you better in the future. But I thought it was an interesting segue into a clip I wanted to play, which comes from Professor Stephen Hicks in a lecture that he delivered almost 20 years ago to the Atlas Society on postmodernism.
Frederick Jameson, whom I mentioned earlier, he's a major postmodernist literary critic, is famous for having said, everything is, in the last analysis, political. Now, this strikes me as deeply Machiavellian, as a statement of a willingness to use any weapon, rhetorical, epistemological, political, to achieve one's ends. If so, a postmodernist doesn't have to believe the relativism in order to use it as a tactic. It works to destabilize the opposition, and the end justifies the means. Relativism, then, on this interpretation, is postmodernism's big lie. It's a pretense. Really, they believe left politics absolutely, and they're just buying time while they're regrouping. Now, here's an example. So I didn't just make this up. Kate Ellis is a radical gender feminist. Ellis, as she writes in Stories Without Endings, believes that sexism is objectively and absolutely evil. Affirmative action is objectively good. Capitalism and sexism go hand in hand. Achieving gender equality requires the overthrowing of existing society. But she has a problem, she says, when she tries to teach her students these themes. Her students think like liberal capitalists. They think in terms of equality of opportunity, of judging everyone by the same standards, of removing the artificial barriers that women have faced. They think that by personal effort and ambition, they can overcome most obstacles and achieve success. This means to her that her students have bought into the whole liberal capitalist framework, that she thinks is dead wrong. So, Ellis writes, she will enlist deconstruction as a weapon against those old-fashioned Enlightenment beliefs. If she can first undermine their belief in the superiority of capitalism, of Western values, the idea that people make or break themselves, their core values will be destabilized. Pushing relativism, she finds, helps achieve this. And once their Enlightenment beliefs are hollowed out by relativistic arguments, she can then, again, turn absolutist and fill the void with politically correct principles. Now, a familiar analogy here may help. I'm proposing that postmodernists are no more relativistic than creationists are, creationists, in their battles against evolution. Postmodernists wearing their multiculturalist garb will say all cultures are equal, not evil, but they are just like creationists who say that all they want is equal time for creation and evolution. Creationists will sometimes say things like both creationism and evolution are equally scientific, or they will say both are equally based on faith. Do the creationists really think that? Well, hell no. They're opposed to evolution. They are convinced that it's wrong and that it's evil. And if they were in power, they would suppress it. However, in the short term, as a tactic, since they're on the losing side right now, they will push for intellectual egalitarianism. And they will argue that nobody knows the absolute truth. The same holds for the postmodernists. They say they want equal respect for all cultures, but really, in the long run, what they want to do is suppress the Western one. I think this Machiavellian interpretation explains why relativistic arguments are arrayed against the Western great books canon. If your deepest goals are political, you always have a huge obstacle to confront. The powerful books written by brilliant minds on the other side of the debate, and there are always lots of them. For example, in literature, there's a huge body of staggeringly wonderful novels, plays, epic poems, and not very much of it supports socialism. A lot of it presents fairly compelling analyses of the human condition from opposed perspectives. In law, another place where postmodernism is very strong, the Constitution and the whole body of common law precedent provides a very powerful obstacle to many socialist agendas. So if you're a left-wing graduate student or a left-wing professor in literature or law, you've got two choices. You can take on those opposing traditions, have your students read the great books and read the great decisions, and argue with them and about them in your classes. Now, that's very hard work, and it's also risky, right? Because they might come to believe the wrong thing. Or you can try to find a way to dismiss the whole tradition so that you can teach the books that fit your politics. If you're looking for shortcuts or if you have a sneaking suspicion that your side won't fare very well in the debate, deconstruction is seducing. Deconstruction allows you to dismiss whole literary and legal traditions as built upon sexist or racist or otherwise exploitative assumptions. That way, you can claim justification for setting them aside. Now, suppose you're making this argument. Do you really have to believe that Shakespeare was a sexist, or that Hawthorne was a secret Puritan, or that Melville was a technological imperialist? No. You just make those arguments, you rid yourself of an obstacle, and then you don't have to read the challenging books, you don't have to explore opposing perspectives, and you don't have to have arguments against them. All right, that's the Machiavellian explanation. Okay. Postmodernism is not so much a leap of faith for the academic left, but a political strategy that uses but does not believe relativism.
So, I just thought it made for an interesting credibility builder for Dr. Hicks, for those of you who are unfamiliar with his work entirely, that his warnings from a generation ago are now, in many ways, the lived reality of my professor friend in a very well-respected political science program in a very, very good school. A couple of other notes. It's very important for me to point out that clip you just heard is taken out of context. That entire talk that Dr. Hicks delivered to the Atlas Society in 1998, it's over 2 hours long. He lays down, I think, four hypotheses about the nature of postmodernism. That was just one of them. The conversation that we have, that you're about to hear, is really just a skimming of the surface of this topic. And the service that I really hope to provide to thousands of people today is alerting them to the existence and the work of Dr. Stephen Hicks. His website is stephenhicks.org. You can get his book, Explaining Postmodernism, there for free. Both text and audio versions are available. And I got a lot of value out of reading the book in preparation for this conversation that I had with him back in late March. Now, I also want to point out that Dr. Hicks is the harshest critic of postmodernism that you are going to hear in this series. So I trust you, the listeners, to be able to identify his objectivist worldview and to integrate that with the rest of the viewpoints that you're going to hear or that you've already heard in this series. My suggestion is not that the postmodern philosophy is inherently evil or destructive. there are greater risks of damage to a young person's psyche, I have come to believe, if it is delivered outside of an understanding of how this movement fits into the larger philosophical picture. But I think even Dr. Hicks would agree that things didn't have to turn out this way with postmodernism. And as we're going to talk about in upcoming shows, it is not an entirely useless philosophical pursuit. Context is very important. You know, I was having a conversation with somebody maybe like a week ago who's more oriented towards the alt-right. And they asked me the Jewish question about the Frankfurt School, which is not, again, synonymous with postmodernism, but the Frankfurt School scholarship does build some momentum towards the postmodern movement that happens, you know, a couple decades later. And my response was, you have to put yourself into the shoes of these scholars who came from Germany to Columbia University in the 1930s. Because if you just set this up in your head as a kind of Jewish conspiracy, and there's plenty of encouragement online to do that, you haven't put yourself in a position to really understand what was going on. It's more like you've dropped yourself into the plot of a comic book, right? When you dehumanize people and you just assume malevolence. These guys are criticized, Marcuse and Horkheimer and Adorno, for being anti-Enlightenment. But if you look at their view of the world in the 1930s, the greatest embodiment of science supplanting faith was ironically Nazi Germany, which was a completely scientifically managed society on the surface, even though the leadership of the Nazi Party embraced a great deal of bizarre superstition and even occultism. But in the 1930s in Germany, the trains ran on time, as the old saying goes. And when they saw how that scientifically managed society was threatening them, it was very much like, oh shit, modernism took us here. This is the consequence. This is the rational and scientific justification for the continuation of and the expansion of the domination system. And people can't be liberated until this is upended. And at that point, hopefully their skepticism starts to make a little bit more sense, right? And the conspiracy is deflated. So just a tangent, but the point is that context helps reduce hysteria, otherizing, and that Manichaean good and evil view of the world. So that's it. Let's get right to it. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come and saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s.
My guest today is Dr. Stephen Hicks. He is a professor of philosophy and the executive director of the Center for Ethics and Entrepreneurship at Rockford College in Illinois. Stephen is also the author of several books, including The Art of Reasoning, Explaining Postmodernism, Skepticism and Socialism from Rousseau to Foucault, and Nietzsche and the Nazis. And Stephen also has an entire course in the philosophy of education, which is something that maybe we could, since it's right in our wheelhouse, maybe we could dig into that at some point in the future. So first of all, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
My pleasure, too.
We have a neat opportunity today. I was saying before we started that the first of your work that I ever experienced, first thing you did that I listened to was a summer seminar from the Atlas Society, which was 20 years ago. Mm. And this was like in January. So this is after for the last couple years, I've been watching the emergence, or at least the emergence as far as I was concerned, and the growth of this social justice movement in higher education. And something in the back of my head was going, oh, this is just some kind of a scheme, you know? I mean, that was my impression of it, where you know, we're told, or the people in the higher education environments and beyond are told, you will be tolerant and politically correct by our standards or else your job, your reputation, maybe now even your physical safety. And it seems like, and, you know, I don't mean to be paranoid here, but the next standard to be rolled out, which is right now just kind of obscured by the thinnest veneer, is like redistribution and economic reparations. Like, that's where this thing seems to go after this language revolution is complete. So I'm sitting there watching this presentation you gave 20 years ago, and I'm just absolutely stunned by some of your suggestions, like postmodernists, which is, there's a strong postmodernist undercurrent to a lot of what we're seeing in the social justice movement, use words as weapons. And they have this ability to be, you know, subjective and relativistic in one breath, but then they can turn and become very dogmatic and absolutist in the next. You know, you raise these interesting questions like, which side is actually stronger? Are they just absolutists using this kind of subjectivity and relativism and it's all personal experience and feelings as a kind of cover? Or is it the opposite? So one of the big takeaways from that talk is you suggested that this is how socialism moves forward. After it failed scientifically, after it failed, I guess, as far as moral arguments were concerned, this is what carries it today, this postmodern movement. So as you look back at the last 20 years, do you feel like you've been, especially like in the last 3 years, like vindicated? I how did he know this 20 years ago? As somebody who's more of a philosophical novice, how did he know this 20 years ago? So yeah, speak to that experience, if you will.
Right. Okay, well, there's a lot nicely packed into your introduction there. Yeah, certainly the universities are in a dangerous place right now. Mm. It is not really accidental that it's at our best universities where we're having the most troubles, right? Because there we have the students who are the most well-educated, the most intelligent. They're most likely to see the implications of what they have been learning. And being energetic young people, they're then the most likely to put it into practice, right? The way that it's meant. So, in that sense, universities are, you know, despite their reputation for being staid and conservative and isolated from the real world, they really are a frontline laboratory, right, so to speak, for what we think is important. This is a long time coming, though. You mentioned a lecture 20 years ago, and there was no necessity, right, that things were going to play out the way that they have over the last 20 years. Of course, my hope and the hope of many other people at that point was to say, look, if we can point out what's going on here, what the stakes are, what the underlying philosophical issues are, how the politics is all rolled up in it, then we can engage the debate, right, more productively and roll some things back. But the way it has gone on is that we have been on the losing end, not so much of the debate. I think the debate is more evenly engaged now, right, intellectually. But there is a generational movement, right, where kind of the dominant, broadly speaking, postmodern ideas, and there's a lot of sub-strategies that are possible there, did come to dominate. They produced the largest number of graduate students. Those graduate students then went on into academic world and broadly into intellectual life. And we're now then seeing what I think of as the third generation of that, right? Those professors, right, who are now mid-career were trained in the 1990s, and they are now training the next generation of younger people. And those are the ones who are taking it to the streets, right, so to speak.
Yeah.
I would say it's actually been a 40 or perhaps 50 year development that the kind of the high theory of postmodernism that undergirds a lot of what you call the social justice movement, such as social justice warrior, repackagings of various kinds of socialism, right, and left wing thought, kind of outright authoritarian versions of political correctness and so on. The high theory for that really was developed in the 1960s and 1970s. Then it was kind of mainstreamed inside the academic world by the 1990s, and that's when I entered into the debate. And then as it was mainstreamed, it then becomes institutionalized, and you then get sufficient numbers and critical mass so that now, 20 years later, it can make a real impact on the conduct at universities. So by way of introduction, I'd say that.
How do you think that mainstreaming happens primarily?
Oh, the mainstreaming certainly happens by intellectual matters, right? Professors make their decisions about what they're going to research and write upon when they start they start new journals. They influence the course of existing journals, so the center of intellectual gravity shifts right across time, particularly in editorships. You know, editors have a lot of power to decide which range of topics are going to be covered and what kind of treatment. And that's all at the kind of the wholesale level, right, for education, where the ideas are to develop among the professoriate and the academics. Mm-hmm. And then at the retail level for education, right, what goes on in the classroom is hugely important. Right? The professors make the decisions, what the textbooks are going to be. They then deliver their lectures and guide the students through the seminar discussions. And they're reaching hundreds, right, or thousands of students. And those students then are intelligent. They absorb the lessons. They then go on to become teachers and journalists and lawyers and screenwriters and so forth, and it spreads out into the culture that way.
Yeah, and you talked about three generations of this thought in academia at this point. And I talked to a couple other professors about this subject, and the example that I'm sure my audience will be tired of hearing about is there's this movie with Michael Keaton that came out 20 years ago. It's called Multiplicity, where
Michael Keaton?
Michael Keaton.
Multiplicity. Okay.
Yeah, and he keeps cloning himself and then a clone of a clone. And as you go through these generations of cloning, you wind up with something very dull at the end. So once you go off the rails, away from reason, as generations continue, eventually you're going to wind up just going back to some of the phenomena that we see today in higher education and in, I guess, political activism. You have some pretty unflattering perversions, I think, of even the original intentions of postmodernism, even just as far back as the 1960s. And I worry I've talked too broadly about postmodernism as like one monolithic thing that is all to be dismissed, which is very dangerous. Like once you identify something, I think this is like a shortcut in thinking. I don't agree with this. This is anti-reason. This is anti-philosophy. So gather it all up and throw it in the trash. And I think that, I mean, postmodernism isn't much more philosophically specific than saying modernism, right? There's probably considerable diversity of thought. There probably are some contributions in the postmodern movement. I've heard you talk favorably about Michel Foucault as an important thinker, even if his conclusions are, you know, untenable in many ways. Do you think, as some have argued, postmodernism has any liberating qualities that objectivists or libertarians would actually be willing to embrace?
So I actually heard three very interesting topics of conversation in your discussion there. Let me take them up in order.
Sure.
First, the three generational phenomenon and the battle over reason, right, in particular, which I think you're right to say is the most fundamental one.
Right.
If you go back, say, to the 1950s and the 1960s, then, of course, the big debate is between those who have an optimistic and a pessimistic view of reason. Right. So the optimistic view would be to say, yeah, sure, reason is complicated. Discovering the truth is very difficult. You have to do a lot of work. But if we persist, we gather the data, we do the analytics, we have the arguments, then out of that we will winnow out the falser ideas, we'll have better ideas, and in some cases we'll actually discover the truth. And that then is seriously engaged, right, by a number of very skeptical, right, philosophers who are reaching negative conclusions, right, that in fact we can't accurately observe the world, right? Logic is a veneer. Conceptualization is arbitrary. Scientific method is a myth, right? And so on. So that debate then is engaged, and the more skeptical side then comes to prevail. And then in the second generation, right? If you're a skeptic, right? Then you start to say things like, well, nobody really knows the truth. Everybody has their own subjective reason. And the implication at that point then is to say that we have to take kind of all people's views as more or less equally valid or equally invalid. So you get a kind of a tolerance, right, that comes out of it. And the view is then to say that, well, there's lots of views that are out there that are equally valid, but we haven't been hearing from them, right, very much. So in the name of a kind of affirmative action, we should strive to give all voices equal hearing, right, inside the campus. And so that means a rebalancing of the books that are read, the kinds of the departments that are created to give voices to voices that have not yet been heard very much. So you end up with a kind of an intellectual egalitarianism, right, that comes out of the skepticism. But then the third generation, right, after that, then is to say, well, look, why should we really take equality of the viewpoint, right, seriously? If everything is just subjective and no one knows the truth, then and it's really my truth against your truth, and we're not going to get anywhere by equal debate, right, among various viewpoints, then all I need to do is just try by any tactics possible to advance my viewpoint, right, and to silence, right, your viewpoint. And that's where we are now. So it's like the third iteration of skepticism in practice. Now, your second point then is to say, yes, like modernism, and postmodernism is a very broad label, right? When we talk about the modern era in history, right, we're talking about 500 years now.
Right.
If we talk about modernism, right, intellectually, that's used variously in different academic disciplines, but even so, then you're talking about multiple centuries. And so at a very high level of abstraction, right, you're capturing a worldview that is more naturalistic, more, right, pro-reason, more individualistic, right, and so forth. But then there are lots and lots of sub-debates in there and lots of variations on modernism that's possible. And the same thing holds on the postmodernism side. If you reject modernism in a very fundamental way, that still leaves a lot of open space for variations, right, on postmodernism. You mentioned my book, Explaining Postmodernism. In the final chapter, I argue that there really are four major variations, right, on postmodernism. So to call it all postmodernism, right, as a movement, that's at a very high level of abstraction, but you do very quickly need to get to the sub-movements. And postmoderns disagree amongst each other, right, on many very important issues, just as the modernists, right, disagree, right, amongst each other. Now, the third question about whether there are positive, right, and liberating elements, right, within postmodernism, as you mentioned, yeah, I have had good things to say about Foucault. Foucault changed his mind on some important issues very significantly over the course of his career, 50s, 60s, 70s, and then his death in the 1980s. And there are things in postmodernism that will strike a chord with people who, broadly speaking, have libertarian, right, not necessarily libertarian politics, but more broadly libertarian, right, sensibility.
Sure.
And in many cases, it's a matter of common enemies, right? Because there are strands of left-wing thought that are more leaning in the direction of anarchy and a kind of libertarianism, but they're targeted against various forms of authoritarianism, right? Religious authoritarianism, political authoritarianism, forms of cultural authoritarianism as well. So Foucault and some of the other postmodernists can be very good and very strong rhetorically at going after some of our common enemies there. But what I would say is there are some things that people, particularly when they are younger, find attractive in postmodernism, but those tend to be the things that postmodernism does have in common with modernism, right? So one common postmodern strategy, and it's a legitimate strategy, is to say there are various forms of belief in reason that are much more, you know, rationalistic and Platonic, or some forms of belief in objectivity that come out in the form of a kind of intrinsic absolutism. Right, or some forms of belief that since there is such a thing as truth, that gives some people the right socially to impose their truth on other people. And to the extent that postmoderns rebel against that, I'm on their side. But I would say, you know, that historically, those points are not original to postmodernism. Those are, in fact, all modernist right points. It was the modernist right who first argued for empirically grounded reason, for liberating the individual, and so to speak, getting rid of that old-fashioned authoritarian pre-modernist approach.
Yeah, something that I think would have, you mentioned this, but I think that would have a natural gravity for young people, for college-aged people, really. I mean, when I was in college 20 years ago, I was very, very attracted to the left immediately, right? It almost satisfied some kind of deep urge, right, to stand up and rebel, to free myself from, sure, you know, so much of what life had been before that. And we talked on the show before about the Frankfurt School thinkers and the idea of critical theory, and how, as I reflected on, I've done this program for 8 years, and I've reflected on things I've said over those 8 years, and I realized that there were a lot of impulses of that leftism kind of left in me in how I looked at the world. It was a pretty easy transition to libertarian thinking for me, because it was this enlightened skepticism, right? It was like finding a new way to be smarter than other people, which I think is something that I've noticed attracts a lot of people to the left, is this kind of unearned moral superiority. A big O objectivism and libertarianism can provide people with that stick as well.
So, there's two components in there. One is the you mentioned the cognitive orientation and the skepticism, and certainly kind of a small s skepticism is very healthy when you are a young person. Because what we do want every generation of young people to do is to think hard about all of the important questions, all of the existing institutions, and to challenge them and not to accept them uncritically, to see the arguments for and against them, the fact that their parents tell them to do certain things, not to accept it just because they're the parents. That's fine when you're four to some extent, but it's not okay when you're 18.
Right, right.
The same thing with respect to schooling and so on. So any intellectual movement that comes along and encourages that natural and healthy tendency in young people to think critically and to think for themselves and to be willing to explore other options is going to be right important. And you know, a big part of modernism, right, is doing that. And postmodernism certainly does tap into that theme, right, that theme as well. The difference, though, is that the modernists say at the end of that process, you should cultivate a mind, right? Your individual mind that's able to exercise good judgment in sorting out what's true from what's false, from what's better, from what's worse, so that you can go on, make your decisions about what's actually right, what's actually true, and use those as a framework for your life. Whereas the postmoderns tend to leave people with that skepticism, and it turns into a big S, right, skepticism. But there is no such thing as truth. And so all we have is a kind of intellectual free-for-all, right, that goes on. The second part of what you're saying, I think, also is important. I think it's, again, natural for younger people. It's a sad truth that most middle-aged people lose it. But to be very morally serious, right, to take values, right, seriously, to have high ambitions, their whole lives are ahead of them. They have enormous amounts of energy and a sense that anything is possible. And so if I become the right kind of person and I do the right kinds of things, I can put together a great life for me, and I can, in fact, right, change the world. And all of those ambitions, right, are fine. To the extent that you are an idealist, though, it's natural that goes with that, that you will experience a great deal of disgust, right, with what you perceive to be a lot of hypocrisy, right, that is in fact out there in the world. And I think so. I think it's legitimate, to the extent that you are genuinely an idealistic person, to feel yourself to be morally superior to those you know who are hypocritical, right, who have sold out, who have given up, right, on various things, right, in life and so forth. So all of that, right, I applaud, right, in young people. But then, of course, the modernists' argument is that you do have to ultimately then transcend, right, that disgust, right, not to let that be your dominant emotion. That in fact it is possible to achieve the good, the beautiful, the noble, and to dedicate yourself to that in your life, right, and so forth. But again, postmodernism stops at that point, right, because it does not believe, right, ultimately, this is the skepticism coming through, that there is such a thing as the good, the just, right, and so forth. From their perspective, they then bring in a very cynical moralism, right, that all of life is just a power struggle, the strong taking advantage of the weak, and they don't actually believe deeply that that is ever going to change. And that kind of deeply cynical assessment of the human condition then means that the negativity tends to dominate. So the only way that you can exert your moral superiority is by expressions of anger, right, and disgust and disdain for your perceived enemies.
So I think about my story and the story of a lot of people that I've worked with, and I'm grateful there was eventually a kind of creative impulse that overtakes the very finite satisfaction of being a critic or a deconstructor. You know, it's interesting. When I first started to look into some aspects of postmodernism, I was thinking, oh, like these are the kind of shitty YouTube commenters of the philosophical and artistic world, the people who just go in and drop some kind of bomb intended to diminish the creator while aggrandizing self and then, you know, anonymously back out of the picture. I know that's very reductive, but it's the same idea.
Right. There is some dark psychological territory there, and that's pretty widespread.
Yeah, it seems like if this becomes chronic, we could get up to what we see today, where there's almost this like urge to destroy, right? That seems very present, to wreck something. It's present not just in like the campus politics of the 21st century, but if you look at postmodern art, like the things that people were doing in the I think the big controversy like around Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, the religious right in the 1990s, there were these funding for the arts debates over people doing things with crucifixes and urine and people.
Yeah, Senator Jesse Helms was at the forefront of. Right, that.
Yeah.
Wanting to eliminate federal funding for things that were obscene, right, and so forth.
Yeah. It almost like there's, in addition to this impulse to destroy as a statement, which I think is what a lot of that art was, and obviously it extends beyond any kind of religious debate. You know, I talked about it recently on my show in kind of a political context. There was this. Very controversial figure named Milo Yiannopoulos, who got a lot of prominence by appearing on a very popular late night talk show, Real Time with Bill Maher, and it was like a real victory for him. Well, the next week, a campaign began to utterly decimate his career down to nothing and send him into the shadows in embarrassment. And you know, I saw a lot of that, like a kind of resentment towards success. A resentment towards somebody else's achievement or self-actualization, and almost a need to punish it. I mean, am I being too cynical?
No, I would say not. We know that there are people who are very nihilistic, right, in their personal psychology. So the interesting thing, though, is why does nihilism, so to speak, come out of the shadows, right, rather than it just being a few isolated and marginalized individuals who have failed in their lives, why does that then become prominent and mainstream, and particularly in our most important, right, cultural institutions? So the universities, right, would be one example. Because you can't just say then a few marginalized individuals who were personal failures somehow came to dominate the entire institution.
Mm.
Or you mentioned the art world, and it certainly is the case. If you look at the trajectory of the high art world for the last century, actually, it's perfect, I think. I think Marcel Duchamp's fountain, that's the urinal that was put on display, I think that was 1917, so we're exactly one century right from that. So if you take that as a benchmark time, you know, the whole trajectory of modernism in its various forms in art and then postmodernism has been highly negative, right? Highly critical, highly angry. And so your question, the way you put it, was before is to say, well, if we think of artists, right, as creative people, ultimately some positive sense of creativity should come to dominate.
Yeah.
That's not to say that artists, right, won't be critical and negative and have dark moods and dark elements right within their oeuvre, right, or their overall body of work. But when that negativity, right, comes to dominate, that it's only critical, right, of other people, when it's only sounding themes of pessimism, skepticism, cynicism, destruction, right, and so forth, then you have a broader phenomenon, right, that needs to be explained. And particularly, I would say, in the case of artists, right, because artists are not necessarily scholarly and academic people, but all of the artists I know are intelligent people, and they certainly are emotionally attuned, deep and sensitive people, and they read and they pay attention, right, to what's going on, and they kind of channel,
yeah,
right, what seems to be the dominant themes in their culture. And so if they read and if they go to university and they are picking up primarily postmodern themes, and I think some psychologically interesting stuff is going to happen, right? Because then you will have people who are attracted to art because they are creative people and energetic and they want to say something. But then what they pick up, so to speak, in terms of their official intellectual framework is something that is pretty unrelievedly negative. Then what's going to come out in their artwork is only negativity, right? And that's going to swamp their creativity, and that's going to be pretty negative. I'm just, as you were speaking about the art, I'm reminded that I think, you know, for the first time in history, as far as I know, in many mainstream modernists, you find that destructive element, right, made explicit. I think it was de Kooning who asked for, right, took another artist's work, right, because he felt that he was standing in the shadow of that work,
mm-hmm,
and kind of obliterated it, right, created over it, and then put his own work on top of that.
Was so, this yeah, the Mona
that
Lisa?
Be that I can only do my thing if I first, right, destroy yours. Or Picasso was famous for taking sketches out of art books by famous artists of the past, Raphael, Rembrandt, and so forth, putting them on the wall, and then when he and his friends got together, they would use them as dartboards. Right? So you would throw darts at and actually destroy the work, right, of other people. Right? Or there was a performance artist, right, in the 1960s who took a grand piano, you know, a beautiful musical instrument, right? It's a symbol of what's been accomplished, right, in the musical world. And he and three or four of his buddies took various implements. Talk about deconstruction, you know, a circular saw, sledgehammer, and their performance art was to destroy the grand piano right before the audience, and that was recorded. Right? Or kind of a feminist artist, I'm thinking of Nikki Santfala, took the Venus de Milo, right, kind of that famous statue of female beauty. Right, mm-hmm. From the ancient world. She did a paper mache, right, version of that, but had it filled with balloons that were filled with paint. And another what she did was then she took a rifle and fired it at the Venus de Milo, thereby destroying it, but also causing the balloon filled with paint to explode. And so you then have the I can only, so to speak, do my art by destroying the previous great creations, right, of the art world. And that, I think, is unprecedented, right, in human history.
Yeah.
So it is a dark but very interesting phenomenon where you have the most attracted to creativity people using their talent and their imagination for destructive and nihilistic purposes.
Yeah, you know, I almost want to launch into a whole line of conversation here about modern comedy, you know, things like The Daily Show and Saturday Night Live, which have almost given up on humor in favor of this kind of deconstruction, right? There's destruction of people, of their political enemies. Like, there's a difference between irreverence and targeting to destroy. And we see that, you know, shows that were once very silly and creative, like Saturday Night Live, don't even care about being funny anymore, you know? Mm. And I think that that seemed that was just what came to mind as you're talking a lot about, you know, how consuming that kind of mindset can be. I was thinking, like, well, do you need this for, like, stand-up comedy generally? Is it, 'cause there wasn't really much in the way of stand-up comedy, you know, observing and criticizing the world before the 1960s and the 1970s. It seems to emerge out of that. But if you want to comment on that quickly, I want to follow up by zooming out from the art world to the whole movement generally, but staying right with the same spirit. Go ahead, though.
I would say, yeah, on comedy, there's obviously a long, long history, right, of comedy being used for negative purposes. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon that, you know, at its heart, right, comedy always has a negative edge to it.
Sure.
It's about the absurdity, juxtapositions of things that don't belong together. And so on. So if you go all the way back to Aristophanes, right, who was a comic genius, he did, in fact, you know, use his formidable talents to attacking and skewering all kinds of people who were political and philosophically, right, his enemies. So I don't want to say that comics, right, can't do that.
Sure.
I think that's an important part of our culture. What I would say, though, about something like the Daily Show and Saturday Night Live, right, and so on, is it might be a more normal institutional decline. I mean, it's fairly normal for, you know, startups in business or any field, including entertainment and comedy, that the first generation, you've got the people who are very creative and the fresh ideas, right, and so forth. But then by the time you get to the second generation and the third generation, you've got a different team of people, and to some extent, they're just riding on the coattails of the people who built the business up. And since they don't have as many original creative ideas, it's easy to go for the cheap targets, and then the show just eventually declines.
Yeah, absolutely. That's interesting. So let's just zoom out from the artistic world.
Yep.
And, you know, you're talking about this negative impulse, or I think I brought up this negative impulse. And one of the cynical questions as I started to engage with some of this postmodern work, or postmodern thought, one of the cynical questions that I ask myself is, do some of these thinkers of the, specifically the mid-20th century, did they set out to undermine the Enlightenment itself? You know, I mean, even though this is a philosophical movement that has this long lineage back to Rousseau, and as you've discussed, definitely like the German idealists, it doesn't come to prominence until the 1960s. And what's confusing to the novice here is that these people were able to look back at the Enlightenment, which was in many ways defined as or defined by reason as a starting point, supplanting faith and superstition, which didn't really seem to lead anywhere good in many cases. I'm curious about how they looked at the dividends that were paid by that change, that embrace of reason, that they were the beneficiaries of. And I think it'd be hard not to realize that. And maybe this speaks to a psychological piece as well, but science, engineering, medicine, free markets, abolition of slavery, the spreading of material wealth, the sudden existence of leisure time, which was never a thing, literacy. And they didn't say, or most of them didn't say, this is something that we can embrace and improve upon, embrace and evolve from here. It seemed like there were many that said, this is something to be undone or attacked. And I don't want to, again, I don't want to gather up thousands of people, thousands of very competent thinkers, and say this was their psychological problem. But there seems to be something there. And I'm wondering if it's, you know, more about the context of the time they were in, the political spirit of that age. What do you think?
Yeah. The nihilists, right, of our time, as you put it quite rightly, do seem to be of a different order, because around them they do have all of the evidence of the world that the Enlightenment, right, has created.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when have women ever had it so good? And it's not to say that everything is perfect, but if
right.
you just look at the progress of the last two centuries, and you look at the status of women in places where the Enlightenment has not, right, touched very much, it's a huge, right, improvement. So when you then have just to focus on that group for a moment, a group of extraordinarily angry, right, feminists, right, who are interested seemingly only in destroying and undercutting the society that made possible their good existence. That is a puzzle.
Yeah.
Or if we genuinely are interested in the elimination of racism and slavery and all sorts of blights like that on humanity, and then we look at the societies that have made enormous progress, right, in eliminating slavery and trying to confront racial attitudes, right, and so forth. And those are the very societies that you are most interested in attacking and undercutting the principles that have made possible the progress. That seems to be some dark territory. I would say there's a couple of things. I don't think you can avoid the psychology. And the psychology is not new to the 1960s, right, and beyond.
Mm.
Right, all the way back to the 1880s and 1870s, thinkers like Dostoevsky, right, in his novels, thinkers like Nietzsche are very acute, right, in diagnosing the nihilistic thinking, right, and attitudes, right, of many of the people, right, of their generation. And there does seem to be a type of individual, right, who typically when younger has high aspirations, but for some reason those aspirations are not met, or they don't think that their aspirations can be met, and their reaction is, to put it crudely, well, then fuck the whole world.
Right? Right.
Shit on the whole world. I just want to blow the whole thing up. And they do not necessarily have a sense of what they want to replace that world with, right? The focus does seem to be just on the blowing up of the world, right, as it is. So a more contemporary example, to go back to the art world, the movie The Fight Club, right, for
yeah.
example, the obviously disturbed, right, young guy, right, in that show, I think his name is Tyler Durden,
mm-hmm.
or maybe Tyler Durden was the alter ego there, Edward Norton, Brad Pitt. You know, the culminating scene is the blowing up of a modern city, right, and all of the financial institutions, the architectural structures, right, and so forth. And that's the culminating scene, but there is nothing right in the movie to say we have to blow up this corrupt system because that's the only way to replace it with something right more beautiful, right, and more decent. It's just the blowing up that you want to do. I don't know, if we go back to creative people, we do know that there is the psychology of the failed artist, right, or the failed, right, creative person, where you want to be the person who's going to write the great American novel. You want to be the next Shakespeare. You want to go to Hollywood and become the next great screenwriter. And you give it a shot, but then you get to 30, you get to 40, and you realize that you haven't written anything, right, or produced anything of significance. And you realize it's not going to happen right for you. And that becomes very ugly inside, recognizing that you're a failure, and that failure and the self-disgust can be then directed outward, right, at other people and other institutions as a way of self-protection.
So, it can be used as an explanation.
That psychology, right, we can't ignore it.
Right.
It's a persistent part of the human condition, right, in every generation. So why we though have to ask is, as we were saying before, why does that then become prominent, right? And why is it not just marginalized, right, in some individuals? And there you always have to go to what are the smartest, most educated, most culturally prominent people saying and thinking. And there, if you have a movement of people who are reaching very broadly philosophically negative conclusions, that's the only way to explain it.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, it seems like that hostility towards the world, like there's lots of tropes about Hollywood being filled with resentful and bitter people who are, you know, getting on in years. It's an explanation. That attitude, that affect towards the world itself is an explanation for one's own failures.
Yeah. So, but then to get back to that philosophical point, right, you're asking about how can people then live in the world that the Enlightenment has created, right?
Yeah,
you know, opportunities for women, attitudes toward race, with elimination of slavery, and right in many parts of the world, the technological achievements, right, and so forth, and still want to say, you know, piss on the Enlightenment, right, so to speak, and so forth. I think the other component really is an intellectual component, although again, you can't get away from the psychology entirely. It is a kind of an occupational hazard of intellectuals to get locked inside their own theories.
Yeah.
So you come to believe, particularly when you're in your 20s and you think deeply about everything, that this philosophical framework is the right philosophical framework, and that comes to shape and color all of your reactions intellectually and emotionally right to everything. And since that's your occupation, you're thinking, you're writing in that every day, in your classes, you're talking about it every day, it becomes very, very difficult for people after doing that for 20, right, or 30 years to conceive of the possibility of an intellectual framework, right, outside of that.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that point about theoretical blinders, right, just leading you to see only this and other things, even though they really are there, they might even be in your visual field, you just don't notice them, right? They get bracketed out by your theory. That is that's a real phenomenon.
Absolutely. So just because we're pressed for time here, I had one final question, a constructive question. What to do, right? I'm sure you've spent some time, you've been in higher education for 25 years or so, and you've probably done some counseling with students on these matters. You've suggested, I know in the past, a kind of division of labor, right? The academy is a small part of the whole intellectual picture. But there's a lot at stake here, and this needs to be confronted. This kind of the postmodern movement there's a lot at stake, right? Sure. If you look at the achievements of the Enlightenment, how do you suggest students engage with and try to counter this postmodern presence in the world?
Mm. What I would say for students is chances are very good in your formal education. You are going to be exposed only to a fairly narrow range of opinions.
Right.
You know, all of the data, right, and all of the surveys that are done about professors in higher education, particularly in the humanities and the related, directly related social sciences, is that the intellectual framework has shifted, right, in a certain direction. When you go to political issues, it's even more right, shifted and narrow. So go into your higher education expecting that you are only or predominantly going to hear voices, arguments, positions articulated from a fairly narrow range in the political and intellectual spectrum. And so if your goal, though, is to become an educated person, that you will then need to go out of your way to find voices and positions and arguments on the other side. So you'll have to do the extra work. Now, those voices are out there. The books are out there. They can be found, but it will take the extra initiative. So I would say every time you read a book, every time you hear a lecture right by your professor, you know, identify what the position is that's being there made. Listen to it. It's chances are it's a good argument that can be made for it, but make sure you are aware that everything is controversial and that there are thoughtful and articulate people on the other side of the debate.
Yeah.
And make an effort to be exposed to those other sides of the argument. Then my hope and my judgment is smart young people, if they look at the arguments on both sides or all sides of any given issue, by and large, I think the truth will come out. You know, reality is on our side. The data are there. The arguments, right, are there. When we compare and contrast positions, people tend to, when reason is operative, come out on the right side.
Absolutely. Well said. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope I can get you back at some point in the future to discuss the philosophy of education.
It would be my pleasure, yes.
We absolutely.
We scratched some surfaces, didn't we?
Indeed. Yeah, we did. Just surfaces scratched, a perfect summation. But I really enjoyed it, and I'm going to make sure that people who are interested in the subject matter we discuss are directed to your work.
Appreciate it. All right. Thanks a lot, Brett.
So, everybody, before we wrap up today, I wanted to leave you with this. It's a clip from the same lecture Dr. Hicks gave at the Atlas Society in 1998. I sped it up a little bit, but this clip still runs about 20 minutes. It's a nice way to finish today because it speaks very well to the potential emotional consequences for young people of learning philosophy and learning history in a vacuum, partly as the result of education being viewed as political work. This clip also works to set up some of our future conversations in this series about Jacques Derrida and his idea of deconstruction and about Michel Foucault. I leave you with this clip as encouragement to go and listen to the whole lecture. It's linked in the show notes. And like I've said many times, this lecture is 20 years old, but it's eerie how relevant it is today. Thanks for your time.
But one final darker psychological twist to add. I have not yet accounted for the nastiness, the obsession with darkness and destruction, perversion, that is characteristic of much postmodernist writing. In older socialist writing, you can often see signs of resentment, envy, anger, exulting in the destruction that the socialist revolution will bring, how those capitalists will finally get what's coming to them. With postmodernism, the negative emotionalism is often more extreme. The sheer love of deconstruction, the chronic deployment of crude ad hominem argument. In my reading of the whole history of the Western tradition, these are unprecedented. Stanley Fish calling all opponents of affirmative action bigots, lumping them in with the Ku Klux Klan. Andrea Dworkin's male bashing in the form of calling all heterosexual males rapists. The rhetoric behind it is harsh. Okay? Or at least behind the emotion, behind the rhetoric, there seems to be strongly felt negative emotion. Okay. Racism and sexism are obviously the current hot issues, so we might expect overheated language in debating them. But the same vituperation is leveled against historical figures, all of those bad, dead, white European males. So if you are reading deconstructions of great authors like Shakespeare, you don't find things like, you know, Shakespeare really is great, and it's kind of sad that I have to point out this element of sexism in him. Okay. It's kind of a gleeful dismissing of all of Shakespeare, okay, because he's got these sexist elements in them. So I want to try to capture this psychological component as well. Okay. And I find that for me, what is most illuminating is Nietzsche's concept of ressentiment. Okay. Ressentiment in the French is close to the English resentment, but it's got kind of a more curdled bitterness. Okay. You know, it's more seething and poisoned and bottled up for a long time. Okay. That's ressentiment. Okay. We're trying to project this psychological state. I kind of like the idea of using Nietzsche here in analyzing the postmodernists, because he's one of the heroes of postmodernism. They cite him for his perspectivalism in epistemology, his use of the enigmatic and loosely structured aphoristic form instead of the more scientific treatise form, his psychological acuteness in unmasking various guises, which is core to the deconstruction methodology. I want to use Nietzsche against postmodernists for a change. Nietzsche uses the concept of ressentiment in the context of developing his famous account of master and slave morality in Beyond Good and Evil, most famously, and more systematically in The Genealogy of Morals. Master morality for Nietzsche is the morality of the vigorous, life-loving, strong. It's the morality of those who love adventure, delight in creativity, in their own sense of purposefulness and assertiveness. Slave morality is the morality of the weak, the humble, those who feel weak, victimized, afraid to venture forth into the big bad world. Weaklings are the chronically passive, largely because they are afraid of the strong. As a result, the weak feel frustrated. They can't get what they want out of life. They become envious of the strong, and they also secretly start to hate themselves for being so cowardly and weak. But no one can live thinking that he or she is deeply hateful. And so the weak invent a rationalization that tells them they are the good and the moral, because they are weak, humble, passive. Patience is a virtue. Right? So they have to wait a long time before they ever get something what they want. So patience is a virtue. Obedience is a virtue. They can't do their own will. They have to obey. So make it a virtue. Humility. And so is being on the side of the weak and the downtrodden, people just like you. And so, of course, the opposites of those things must be the evil. Aggressiveness, pride, independence, being physically and materially successful. Does this sound familiar? Sure. But of course, Nietzsche says, it's a rationalization. And a smart weakling is never quite going to convince himself of it. And that will do damage inside. Meanwhile, the strong will be laughing at him. And that will do damage inside. And the strong and rich will carry on getting stronger and richer and enjoying life. And seeing that will do more damage inside. Eventually, the smart weakling will feel such a combination of self-loathing and envy of his enemies that he will need to lash out. He will feel the urge to hurt in any way he can his hated enemy. But of course, he can't risk direct physical confrontation. He's a weakling. His only weapons are words. Now, in our time, the capitalists are the strong, the exuberant, the active. For a while in the past century, socialists could believe that the revolution was coming, that woe would come to them that are rich and blessed would be the poor. but that hope has been dashed cruelly. Capitalism now seems like a case of price two makes four. And like Dostoevsky's Underground Man, it's easy to see that the most intelligent socialists would just hate that fact. Socialism is the loser, and if the socialists know that, they will hate that fact, they will hate the winners for having won, and they will hate themselves for having picked the losing side. Hate, as a chronic condition, leads to the urge to destroy. But again, your only weapons are words. How can you use words to destroy? I think the whole idea of deconstruction comes out of this. Postmodernism is populated by large numbers of people who like the idea of deconstructing other people's work. It's the opposite of constructing something of your own. Now consider parallel examples from the world of visual art. I think the visual art world was a little ahead of the postmodernists this century. Asked to submit something for display at the Art Institute of Chicago, Marcel Duchamp sends a urinal, which is then displayed. This makes a statement about art. Art is something you piss on. Or there's the painter de Kooning's version of the Mona Lisa, a reproduction he makes of Leonardo's masterpiece with a cartoonish mustache added. Now that, too, makes a statement. Here's an achievement I can't hope to equal, and so I'll turn it into a joke. I'll, in effect, destroy it. So you become a bully and a thug, not because it destroys something bad, but just because it feels good to wreck something. So if words are your weapons now, and you want to destroy the achievements of Western civilization, especially the Enlightenment, how do you do it? Well, consider a more personal case. If you hate someone and you want to hurt him, hit him where it counts. Do you want to hurt a man who loves his children and hates child molesters? What would be the worst thing you could say about such a guy? Well, accuse him publicly of child molesting, or better yet, spread sneaky rumors that he's a child molester. Do you want to hurt a woman who takes pride in her independence? Spread through the gossip grapevine that she married the man she did because he's wealthy. Now, the truth or the falsity here of the rumors doesn't matter. And whether you believe them yourself doesn't matter. And whether the people you believe them or tell them to really believe them doesn't matter. They get out there and they do their damage. What matters is that you score a direct hit in the psyche of your enemy, your target person. You know that the accusations and the rumors are going to cause some tremors, even if they come to nothing. And you get that wonderfully dark glow inside of knowing that you did it, right? And they might just come to something after all. Now, my best example of this psychology comes from the deadest and whitest of the dead white European males, and that's Shakespeare. Think of Iago and Othello. Now, here, I think Shakespeare nailed this psychology centuries ago, long before the postmodernists. What we've got is Iago just hates Othello, but he couldn't hope to defeat him in open confrontation. So how best to destroy him? Well, hit him where it hurts most, his passion for Desdemona. Hint that she's been sleeping around. Spread subtle lies and innuendo. Raise a doubt in Othello's mind about the most beautiful thing in his life, and let that doubt work like a slow poison. Now, like the postmodernists, Iago's only words or weapons were words. The only difference between the postmodernists and Iago is that the postmodernists are hardly subtle. Now let's bring it back to then the Western tradition. The Western tradition, it prides itself on its commitment to equality, justice, open-mindedness, making opportunity available to all. The West is proud, full of itself, confident, and it knows that it's the wave of the future. This is unbearable to someone who is totally invested in an opposite and failed outlook. And so that pride is what you want to destroy. Your best bet then is to attack the West's sense of its own moral worth. Attack it as racist and sexist, then, as inherently dogmatic and cruelly exploitative. Undermine it at the core. The words don't have to be true in order to do their damage. And so I don't think it's accidental that postmodernism has launched the kinds of attacks on the core values of the West, and it's done so knowing full well that the accusations it's making are not true. It's a psychological compulsion in some cases, and so that allows you to hold the contradiction. You can be an absolutist in your assertions, and you can assert the relativism, and it just doesn't matter, as long as it's harming someone. Your enemy, that's fine. That's the final explanation, or my final hypothesis here. I call it the nihilist explanation, for obvious reasons. I think some postmodernists, the worst of them in many ways, are individuals of deep ressentiment psychologically, and that the combination of alienation, bitterness, envy, and rage leads them to lashing out with an intent to destroy any aspect of culture that seems to them to be the opposite. All right, now I was going to bring a slide, but I forgot, so let me kind of summarize the whole thing in a little flowchart. I think it starts here, we'll use Marx as a name, with socialism. Socialism is the deepest part. Socialism goes along until the middle part of the 20th century, and then it reaches a crisis. In parallel, what's going on in epistemology, starting with Kant, is a development that leads in the middle part of the 20th century to some sort of relativism and subjectivism. Okay. The left thinkers at this point, confronting their crisis, are looking for a way out. And so what they do is they integrate this, and you get a little aha phenomenon. Let's put these two together. And then at this point, in effect, the philosophy is done, and what you then have is three possible routes to explore, depending on what your psychological preferences are going to be. The first option is the Kierkegaardian option. If you want to maintain your belief in socialism as an article of faith, against all of the evidence, this relativism and subjectivism will do that for you. So this will justify the leap of faith for you personally continuing to believe in the socialism. If you need a new strategy, argumentative, rhetorical strategy, in order to try to continue the battle against capitalism, then what you will do is adopt a Machiavellian strategy. This means that you will continue to believe in your left-wing politics. You won't necessarily believe the relativism, but you will employ it as a political tactic against capitalism. And then finally, if this crisis is legitimate and deeply felt, then what you will have is just an urge to destroy capitalism. Not because you're ultimately thinking socialism is going to win, not necessarily that you personally believe it anymore, but what you then have is just a straight nihilism here. So that's my argument. I haven't argued today that postmodernism is false.
Okay.
Or yesterday. This has mostly been intellectual history. And I wouldn't argue that any of the issues that it raises can be set aside. Okay. The issues of skepticism, realism versus anti-realism, the relationship between reason and emotion, the dimensions of individualism and collectivism and human nature, all of these are ongoing debates in the intellectual community, and they should continue to be so. What I think my argument shows is that postmodernism, that collection of ideas, is a function of left-wing politics. Postmodernism is a rhetorical strategy developed by the left's deepest thinkers in response to the felt crisis of the old left. It's a movement that was set by the agenda was set by the deepest thinkers, and it's being carried out in a variety of intellectual fronts, literary theory, education theory, legal theory, and so on. And I think on all of those fronts, especially the epistemological front and the political front, the battles have to be engaged in all of their various dimensions. The postmodernist philosophy is the death knell of everything the Enlightenment stands for. It took centuries of philosophy to overturn feudalism and make the Enlightenment possible. And philosophical battles are never over forever, and so the Enlightenment's philosophical tradition needs constant rejuvenation in order to maintain its successes. It's worth pausing here, I think, for a moment, just to consider exactly what's at stake, what the Enlightenment achieved and what postmodernism is rejecting. And here's a list of the Enlightenment's successes. Science, both in the explosion of knowledge that science has created and in the conceptual idea of there being a scientific method that you can apply self-consciously. Engineering, the systematic creation of new technologies. Medicine, from anesthetic to antiseptic to invasive surgery to antibiotics to x-rays and so on and so on. Business, the marshaling of capital on a large scale, the development of financial markets, the international network of businesses, the increased number and variety of career opportunities. Undergraduates worry about getting a job. How many career opportunities do you have now compared to 600 years ago? Free markets are an Enlightenment product. Liberal democratic government, constitutionalism, the end of slavery, the diminishment and almost ending of the subordination of women, the very idea that progress is possible, and the liberating feeling of optimism that comes with believing in progress, the exponentially rising wealth, the major increases in the available leisure time that we all enjoy, a more than doubling of average life expectancy, near universal literacy, the explosion in the arts, just in the sheer amount of painting, novel writing, poetry writing, sculpture, and music that's being created, the development of new art forms like the movie. Now, I think that the philosophy that underlies all of that is worth saving, but it needs constant saving. The Enlightenment philosophy was not completed. It did not develop a satisfactory realist epistemology, and it did not develop an individualistic ethic. Those were the things that left it vulnerable. Those were the things at the fundamental level postmodernism attacking, the reason and the individualism. The themes of postmodernism are not new. They've always been a minority tradition in Western intellectual life. Western culture, in my reading of it, is uniquely self-conscious, and it often has doubts and second thoughts about its core values. And it is rich and strong enough to afford intellectuals who articulate those doubts. Many of those thinkers are deeply alienated from their cultures. Rousseau, most famously, Marx, to a large extent, Nietzsche, in some respects, and with more justification. But what's different about postmodernism now is that it is the dominant academic tradition in the humanities, and it's in a position to do serious damage, more serious damage. So the question then is, how do we go about defeating it? The task of professional philosophers is to deal with all of postmodernism's components, to develop the technical arguments needed to respond to postmodernism comprehensively, from metaphysics and epistemology through ethics and political theory. But there's a division of labor here in two ways. Professional philosophy is a very small, though foundational, part of the academy. And so there's a huge amount of work that philosophically informed academics in other fields do. They pick up the debate as it applies to history, to law, to literary criticism, to educational theory, to the practice of science. The other division of labor is between those inside and outside the academy. The academy, again, is a small, very small, though foundational part of a whole culture. And there's a huge amount of cultural work that is done by informed, motivated, and committed individuals outside the academy. A culture is maintained by what is decided over the dinner table, on school boards, in local, state, and federal politics, on museums and art gallery boards, in debates in newspapers and magazines, by people who write op-eds, columns, letters to the editors, in managers' meetings when people are deciding hiring policies, advertising campaigns, where to spend philanthropic dollars, in the coffee shop in the morning, the water cooler over break, in the bars and the restaurants in the evenings. In an open society, the debates go on at all levels of culture all the time. And so for interested parties, opportunities to confront postmodernism and to advance Enlightenment values are limitless. But nobody can do it all, so we each need to pick our targets. When I'm in the situation of arguing postmodernism, I've made a policy to ask myself two questions early on in the discussion. I always seem to picture myself in a bar about midnight with fellow graduate students arguing over beer. I had my first significant encounters with postmodernism in graduate school. Most of graduate school goes on in the bars, not the library. So I think that made a least lasting impression. Now, the two questions are, when I'm judging my interlocutor, is this person honest? Okay. And second, what matters most to this person? Okay. The first is important because it's easy to waste a lot of time discussing things with people who aren't really interested in thinking something through. They may seem to enjoy debate initially, but it's a game. Right? They're not really open to having their premises challenged or to think through their assumptions. The mark of this is almost always evasiveness, switching the subject when hot water is sensed. And it's just not worth it to pursue if our idea is to get to the truth here. Life is short. Now, there's an exception here, especially when you're early in your career. If you want to sharpen your debating skills, then go for it. Or if you want to just really get a concrete image of how evasive people can be and learn to spot evasiveness, do it. Okay? The second question is, what matters most to this person? This question allows you to focus most effectively your time that you spend in the debate. For an example, any discussion about postmodernism is going to wander from politics to historical claims to epistemological claims about interpretation, relativism, and subjectivism. Now, here's my bold claim. 95% of the time, the politics is what matters most to your interlocutor. So focus on that. The epistemology and whether the Aztecs really performed sacrifices, those are way secondary. They're window dressing. In my experience, if you're arguing with postmodernists, especially in English literature, law, and history, they didn't come to postmodernism via epistemology. They had a political agenda, and they only later backed into relativistic epistemology. So you're not going to change anyone's minds by proving that the census are valid or that Columbus was a nicer guy than Montezuma. There's a follow-up point here about focusing on the politics. And here I would recommend that you emphasize the positive. By that I mean focus on the case for capitalism and liberalism and de-emphasize arguing against socialism. Both of these need to be done, but not only is it more enjoyable to focus on talking about why capitalism is so great, it's more effective. Socialists are usually well aware of the problems of socialism, so mentioning them is fine just to show them that you know what they are, but that's not going to make the case for capitalism. Socialism often gets much of its impetus from a failure to visualize any alternative. In part, this is driven by traditional mischaracterizations of capitalism. So hammer home the successes of the Enlightenment philosophy, medicine, standard of living, freedom, extension of the franchise, etc. There's lots and lots of data available, and these things can be used to great effect in debate. And hammer home especially the individualism that lies beneath the liberal capitalistic vision. The importance of being an end in yourself, setting your own goals, figuring out the means, prizing one's creativity, ingenuity, and responsibility. These are all the things that capitalism protects and nurtures, and these are the things that get people turned on, much more than a dismal listing of socialism's failings. All right, I have emphasized the politics and the psychology and de-emphasized the epistemology in dealing with postmodernism. Nonetheless, the epistemology is crucial, and the technical work in epistemology needs to be done and marketed effectively. And I think here objectivism has a unique voice. Without that, the philosophical world will be chronically subject to subjectivism, and in a climate of subjectivism, some future irrationalist cultural movement will rise up to take advantage of it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.